in the movie Superman, there's a crucial dramatic scene where on top of the high Daily Planet building, in a helicopter accident, Lois Lane falls over the edge of the building and is falling. The camera shifts to wonderful Christopher Reeve coming out of the building as Clark Kent, notices the falling Lois Lane, rushes into a revolving door, and a split second later comes out as Superman and zooms up and catches her. And he says, with all of his Christopher Reeve gentleman's decorum, a la Superman, "Don't worry, I've got you." And beautiful Lois Lane beautifully retorts, "You've got me. Who's got you?" This is the lesson of context. Life has context within context within context because nature works that way. And we have found that the essential movement of context is by phases. So that in this nature, form is not a static outline, which is then colored in. But form is always a phase form progression. And even though some progressions take a very long time, one of the most stable forms in the universe is the form of the proton. And the proton lasts 10 to the 32nd years, which is a long time. 10 with 32 zeros. But after that length of time, the proton loses its capacity to hold its form because the ecology of the phase form process is finished. So that eventually we have learned everything in nature is, as the Buddha described, impermanent. Nothing in existence is permanent, including time forms, or atomic forms, or life forms. This means that to be practical about nature is to be practical about the context and that silence as a context is a way of being conscious about what we would call the zero base, and that this zero base is included in whatever line of progression, whatever line of phase form progression, and that this line can be very often a curved line, and that for simplicity's sake, circles can be made, not razor edge circles, but the kinds of squiggly circles that atomic particles make as they spin around, or that children make when they begin scribbling, and the kind of squiggles and circles that are made in random chaos theory, and that eventually, if you let this process go to be en natural, what occurs most pristinely in chaos theory is that one ends up not with a single circle, but with a double circle, with a butterfly effect, with a pair. They're called Lorentz attractors for the man who first named them in chaos theory. One ends up with this butterfly effect. One ends up with this rough infinity sign. And so nature discloses this kind of formal pattern and that the formality of the pattern is accentuated here in this cross section, but that essentially nature consists of a double phase form cycle. And the fact that the two parts, the paired halves, are not precisely identical ever, but they are similar, gives us natural principles which we can trust. That paired similarity characterizes nature. And so the earliest form of prayer for our species on this particular planet, in this star system, was always to hold up two hands, two arms, slightly askew, and in Paleolithic times, the sun on one palm and the moon on the other palm, exactly the same size, or the sun and the moon having similar size. And this was the earliest form of prayer for our species. In classical times, this was called the Orans position. And it was only due to a phase form progression of the integration of human society in historical times that the two palms were brought together and prayer became this. Now we're going to move from nature to ritual, and so we want to prepare our context. We want to set ourselves to be ready for the context, to realize that nature is going to be the context now for ritual. Just as we will experience 3 months, 4 months from now, that ritual is the context for myth. And just as nature is a context, and ritual is a context, and myth is a context, there is a central integral core of symbol that holds all of this together. And in the most ancient iconographical expressions of our species on this planet, in this star system, that was singled out as the first primordial image of the wisdom of life, and it was called the tree of life. And if one takes a pen and makes this form on a sheet of paper, one gets a primordial image which is recognizable for many thousands of years. The context of nature, the context of ritual, the context of myth, with a central synthesizing core of symbol. This tree of life, which originally had branches, became honed just like the double attractor image, and it became the symbol of the tree of life, honed and integrated to the menorah. Now one can go to the large 13-volume Jewish Symbols in the Greco-Roman Period by E.R. Goodnow and can find that the symbol of the menorah was consciously used for at least 2,000 years before the Hellenistic era, and that it was used for at least 20 or 30,000 years before it was appropriated as a symbol for a certain ancient tradition, which still holds today. Nowhere in that ancient tradition is there an indication that this was a doctrinaire sign, but always that the symbol had a mythic context, and that the myth in its mythic context had a ritual context, and that that ritual context had a natural context. So that we must understand that our educational pattern here is as trustworthy as the proton. It in no way is doctrinaire. It has no indoctrination capacities unless misused, and the structure of the way in which the pattern is presented is that abuse and misuse will self-modify, and those who abuse and misuse it will educate themselves in the process of trying to manipulate it and will stop long before they do too much damage. Now, this process, like nature, takes attentiveness. You cannot crib it into a weekend. You cannot have it spotty here and there, because it is so evanescent in its boundaries. Its outline is so iridescent and scintillating that it's very difficult to pick up, even with continuity. And with spottiness, without continuity, the chances of being able to pick up the gestalt are near nil, which is usually why it hasn't been picked up in times where the education does not have a continuity extending over at least an entire year, if not several years, if not decades long attentiveness. And we will find that the whole purpose of ritual was to ensure that the context of nature was selected and presented in such a way that the ritual context would hold itself long enough to be a crucible in which the language of truth could be distilled. For without the language of truth being distilled out of existence, without existential action being distilled to the words of truth, there would be no chance to further crystallize the central synthesizing symbol. And without the central synthesizing symbol, the mind has no shape and acts as a virus instead of a form of life. And the mind, without a shape as a virus, leeches back in through clever lying words. And that leeches back into the world of existence and action and changes it. And that finally leeches back into nature and poisons. And nature has a built-in response to those who will poison the ecologies. Anti-poisons come and take care of the critters. So that an education which is a wisdom education is markedly different from instruction that leads to pieces of paper saying that you have received the doctrines that will get you the jobs, that will get you the paychecks, that will pay the bills. The big bill that's due is from Mother Nature. And she exacts with a relentless completeness. Let's come back to context. We would like to understand something about how paredness in nature becomes in more organic, natural lives, becomes sexuality. that somehow sexuality is a paredness that is characteristic of a more integrated, organic form of nature brought together into life forms. In order to shortcut and short circuit a great deal of misunderstandings and associative underbrush, I've chosen to introduce the subject by bringing in a book from about 10 years ago, The Molecular Basis of Sex and Differentiation, published in Berlin, but in English, subentitled A Comparative Study of Evolution, Mechanism, and Control in Microorganisms. And the authors preface each section of the book, each chapter, with little quotations. The very first quotation is from Oliver Wendell Holmes, the great American judge and wisdom character. The quote reads, "Man's mind, stretched to a new idea, never goes back to its original dimensions. Once the mind is stretched to fly like Superman, it never reverts back to Clark Kent wondering what to do." Here, on page 122, chapter 9, pheromone-mediated control of sexual activity, the list of initial quotations are Madame de Stael, Guy de Maupassant, Vincent van Gogh, and Khalil Gibran. Just to give you the quote from Madame de Stael, "Love is the emblem of eternity. It confounds all notion of time, effaces all memory of a beginning, all fear of an end." In the world of life, which is of the essence of nature, human experience has found that love, as a synthesizing energy, holds all of the phase form ecology in its wholeness, so that one does not need to worry about beginnings or ends, or even middles, but that the ongoingness of the continuity is what is of importance. And this is consistent with an appreciation of nature in the most practical, realistic, fundamentally accurate, and finally truthful fashion. This quality is brought out by the peculiarity that nature loves similar paredness, and that sexuality has something to do with similar paredness. And one must understand that this is not a cut and dried, reduced, die-hard identity, and that even the principle of insisting on like equaling like is sometimes misleading, and one has to take very lightly the like is attractive to like, and hold it very lightly, and not clench it, especially as if it were some kind of polarized accuracy of an identical absolute exactness. Because the harder one clenches for this absolute exactness, the more elusive is any understanding whatsoever. In a letter one time, Ezra Pound, writing to a correspondent about James Joyce, said that Joyce was a man who was electrocuted by divine fire because he would not let go of the hot wires of truth. In Roman times, Mark Antony was electrocuted by the same divine fire that energized Julius Caesar. While Julius Caesar could handle it, because he had a symbolic core that was held by family and personal mythology, that was context by an ancient ritual, and that held by the powers of nature, Mark Antony was an actor upon a stage, and he pretended, and one cannot pretend in nature. You can hold pretense in a dramatic ritual, but you cannot allow pretense to leach back into nature. Nature does not like pretense and activates very quickly the countermeasures against pretense that are famous. So let us not be like James Joyce or Mark Antony, electrocuted by various kinds of divine fire. Let's take a more genial, more natural, more existentially real, and finally, more truthful languaging of the symbolic forms which have their roots in reality. In life forms, out of the organic stuff of the universe, out of the organic forms that have their own phase form ecologies, inorganic material goes through a transformation and becomes organic cells. The very first organic cells that appear, that have viability in our experience on this planet, in this star system, those cells are of the blue-green algae, the bacteria of blue-green algae. And those cells have a structure where the outside boundary folds in, and that simple folding in becomes the way in which those cells are defined and held. And those cells are called prokaryote, to make them distinct from all other organic cellular forms, which are called eukaryotic. And all other life forms have several distinguishing structural aspects which are not there in the blue-green algae. Just to name three, they all have a nucleus which has its own membrane, a nuclear membrane. They all have well-defined chromosomes which carry the genes. And they all have mitochondria, which are energy converting areas of the cell. And what kind of fuel would these areas use? All the kinds of fuel that we refuse to eat now. Sugars, fats, protein. And without sugars, fats, or protein, life is not going to happen on a eukaryotic level. So one has to watch out for doctrinaireness that forbids the use of life fuel for life processes, and watch out for doctrinaire positions that are nonsensical if brought into absolute forms that are really antithetical to nature. Now, a simple way to say all of this which sounds trite, is that if you're going to be alive and conscious in nature, you have to be familiar with the place in which you live. And the largest context of the place in which we live is nature, and that's why our education has begun here. But we want to now begin to shift towards ritual, but we want to make this transition towards ritual in such a way that we understand that the structure of ritual is like the structure of the body. It is a form that occurs within the process of life. Just as life is a process, and the body is a form of that process, which has its own phase form ecology. It begins, it has a certain extension, and it dies. And has a certain extension again, and is reborn. This ecology of a life form is difficult to appreciate in any kind of non-continuous way. Now, looking ahead in our education, the very first pair of books that we're going to use in ritual, Black Elk Speaks, The Seven Rituals of the Sacred Pipe, the Calumet, of the Oglala Sioux, and the complement to it is Gladys Reichardt's great Navajo Medicine Man sand paintings. Now, we want to get off to the right start in the context of ritual, and the right start is to remember that we have to carry nature with us. Everything that we are discussing up to now, we have to carry with us. We cannot forget it. We cannot set it aside. It's not in the past. It's not something which we have covered and no longer need to cover. It's not information that we have been tested on, have passed the test, and now we need new information for a new test. This entire bogus instructional model has to be chucked, thrown away. It's not of any use. We must carry nature with us so that when we come to ritual, we will see that at the beginning of ritual, where we look at two different tribes of the American Indians, the North American Indians, the Oglala Sioux in the north and the Navajo in the south, that in this paredness, one finds a very interesting way of paredness occurring. For instance, the Navajo are travelers who came to the American Southwest from the north. The Navajo language is Athabascan, and the closest language forms are the Cree Indians in northern Canada. So the Navajos are northern people, even more northern than the Sioux. And the Sioux in Black Elk's time had migrated from homes that were further to the east and only came very recently, only a couple of hundred years ago, into the lands which they occupy now and have said that they have been there since time immemorial. They've been there less than the time that Europeans have been on the continent. And just as the Navajos are usually very tall and are very at home on horseback, their closest neighbors, the Hopi, are very short and they always walk. And that the Hopi language is Uto Aztecan and comes from the very far south, like Mexico City. And that the Hopis linguistically are very ancient and have a blood type quite distinctly different from the Navajo. And that the Navajo belong, in fact, to a more recent, only about 12,000 years ago, migration from Asia, whereas the Hopis belong to a very old least 20 to 25,000 year old migration. And we will see that ritual always takes nature into its reality so that the body of a ritual year is the existence, the existential form in which nature must occur to allow for this life cycle to take place. And that part of the structure of a ritual year is the recognition that sexual differentiation, sexual paredness, has nothing to do with doctrine, has nothing to do with sociological fact, has something to do with molecular structure, has something to do with the way in which eukaryotic cells have their life cycle. And we must insist in our education on going, on delving, on penetrating to this depth of natural context and structure in order to understand in a more realistic, practical, and forthright way the answers to some very profound questions. Who am I? What are we doing here? Where are we going? These questions are quite realistic and do not have their answers elsewhere. Now, when it comes to the molecular basis of sex and differentiation, we can excerpt from the book a couple of quotations. Information available through the study of microorganisms will be directly applicable to higher organisms. So if we study microorganisms, because their structure, the information concerning them, is incorporated all the way along the phase form development of more complex organisms, this leads to the understanding that molecular processes controlling complex interactions in multicellular organisms will have their rudiments in the essential life-endowing characteristics of the simplest bacteria. Which means even though all eukaryotic cells have mitochondria, they have chromosomes, they have nuclear membranes, the ultimate context for cellular organic life is on the prokaryotic level, and that foundation of folding in upon itself to make an initial structure, which is then modified by other developments that the chromosomes, the mitochondria, the nuclear membranes modify the prokaryotic structure. One has to understand that life forms in nature, which will be recognized in ritual again and again, life forms in nature basically have an infold. They have a fold. They have a structure which looks like a folded sheet of papers. And that this infolding takes the fundamental form in life on this planet, in this star system, of a response, a tissue response to water. And the tissue response to water is, on one side, this side of the tissue likes water, hydrophilic, loves water, whereas this side is hydrophobic, hates water, does not like water. And when one has an infolding like this, one has the possibility of pairs of tissue membranes on most primitive, on most primordial level of being hydrophobic or hydrophilic, a paredness. And that with just this beginning structure, nature has evolved enormously complex organisms like ourselves, and that we have deep within us more primordial than some Freudian id, more primordial than some kind of reptilian brain, more primordial than anything else, is a paired response, structural response to water. And that all rituals will have within it on fundamental, deep level, a response to inviting water plus a response to making dry land out of too much water. So that while there are rain-making ceremonies, there are also sun-drying-out-the-land ceremonies. And we will find that this is a characteristic on the ritual level. And that in this ritual comportment, deeper than our species, the males, the masculine, the masculine molecules characteristically gravitate to the boundary and patrol the boundaries to make sure that they're integral, tight, that they will hold. And the feminine go to the center to make sure the center holds. This has nothing whatsoever to do with sociological issues. It's not a political statement. It has something to do with the very foundations of the way in which nature happens. Now, there may be other star systems that have other planets, that have other life forms that are differentially remarkably different from this. We do not know of them yet. But for us, this is the way it is. So that when Jane Goodall, studying chimpanzees, studies the life cycle of chimpanzees, the little male chimpanzees at very early age start exploring the boundaries of the territory, and the females start getting into nesting and mating and eating in the center. And only when the perimeter is secured and safe by the alpha male and his companions do the females and their children then have excursions to feed or mate or explore in those areas. So that primates on level of chimpanzees already have this kind of a parity in structure. And the earliest rituals of Homo sapiens sapiens take into account, incorporate, integrate, and bring this context into play. So that the rituals of the male shooting chant for the Navajo Indians are remarkably different from the female participation in same ritual cycle. And just to ensure that there's not a sexist projection on this, we're going to use the female anthropologist Gladys Reichard, who was able to spend a great deal of time with the Navajos, whose classic book, Navajo Religion, in about 1,000 pages, is still available. And we're going to use her book on Navajo medicine man sand paintings in a very particular way. the men and women together will start reading chapter 4, which is legend and sand painting of the bead chart. And it begins with a simple sentence: every chant has a legend upon which its procedure is based. Now, the procedure we will see in our education comes out of an observation of nature and a doing of similarity of phase form processes with nature. And out of that distills the legend. And then the legend adds a kind of contextual center held by a symbol. So it isn't that the chant is the basis of the ritual so much as the ritual infuses the language, and the chant ensures that the phase, form, pace of recitation is like the heartbeat of nature and follows that way. So all of us will read Legend and Sand Paintings of the Bead Chant, Chapter 4. But I would like the men only to read Chapter 5. The chapters are only 4 or 5 pages. Don't get too uptight about the assignments. Chapter 5, Legends and Sand Paintings of the Male Shooting Chant, The Visit to the Sun. So if the men will read chapter 5, the women can read chapter 6. Again, legend and sand paintings of the male shooting chant, but adventures among the earth people. And so chapter 6 talks about changing woman and her two daughters, whereas chapter 5 talks about the holy twins. Two daughters, holy twins, a pair of pairs, making a quaternary, making a square, making a form which is there in stability. And just as the square is a stability, it's a stability on level of symbol and language. The square is intimately connected with the circle, which is stability in nature and ritual. And we will see that bringing squares and circles together is a very comprehensive meeting of pairedness. And that when integration happens as a total pattern, squared circles characterize that wholeness. Just as at one time, at the very beginnings of an age of genius in northern Italy, Giotto, one of the greatest artists that the world has ever produced, built this fantastic campanile, designed it to be a beacon of a new wholeness in the center of Florence, Italy, and then designed the cathedral to go with that campanile, and made this design in such a way that one would have to put a circular based dome on a squared base, and that it took about 300 years for an architect to come along who could put a circle on a square in such a way that it would hold. And that when Brunelleschi discovered how to do that with his friend Donatello, he was in Rome measuring every conceivable thing, and in measuring the Pantheon, a building that had been built by a great genius architect named Agrippa in the time of Augustus Caesar, for they had understood the ancient wisdom that squares and circles do go together, but they go together in a rather esoteric way. And in constantly measuring everything, the young Brunelleschi and Donatello measured everything in Rome and discovered finally that there is a modulation in number that translates into architecture that allows for this to happen. And so the great cathedral in Florence, the Duomo, called the Dome, because the building of the dome was a signal that the ancient wisdom had come back and that man could build again, just like he had once built before. The Pantheon is named the Pantheon, all the gods in one building, because that was a revival of ancient wisdom then, some 1,500 years before Brunelleschi. Where does that wisdom train end? It doesn't end. It phase form modulates back into the atomic structure of stuff and is there already. Let's take a break. Two distinct but related a pair related it's like a positive and a minus. What happens with a positive and a minus together? In nature, when you have a polarity, and the polarity is held at a phase where that polarity is stable, there is a tension between the poles, between the negative and positive pole. If you maintain that stability from micro instant to micro instant in a continuity, that tension moves in a vector which is called the electric vector. The electrons held, you could use the term trapped, energy tends to become particles which move in a perpendicular electric vector to the poles. So that with a positive and minus pole, you get electricity flowing. This is entirely characteristic of nature. Not only will the electricity flow in a vector perpendicular to the tension of the polarity maintained from microinstant to microinstant, but you will get a complement to it, which is the magnetic quality, which is like a radiant cloud around the synthesizing electric vector, so that you will have electromagnetism as a field throughout the magnetic quality as well as the electric vector. On level of life in our species, male and female work in this way. We will see that characteristically in ritual that women hold the center and men hold the boundaries. And that men in a point of transformation will want to explore the center, and women in a transformation will want to explore the boundaries. And that this complementation in the transformative phase is one of the foundations for maintaining a realistic connection of life with nature. So that even on level of molecular basis of sex and differentiation, let's come back to the quotation that we had before the break. Information available through the study of microorganisms will be directly applicable to higher organisms, and molecular processes controlling complex interactions in multicellular organisms will have their rudiments in the essential life-endowing characteristics of the simplest bacteria. This unity principle in biology is possibly the most important concept facing the modern-day biologist. It allows extrapolation of information from one organism to another, as well as integration of basic facts obtained through the study of multiple species. Nevertheless, it does not preclude diversity and the selective function. It's a quotation from the introduction, page Roman numeral 8. The follow-up quotation from page 122. Chemical agents regulate cellular metabolic activity, rates of protein synthesis, and spatial morphogenesis, all differentiating biological systems, sexual conjugation, essential, developmental, species preservation, irreversible linear differentiation, and programmed death. Similar agents and mechanisms would have co-evolved to regulate germ-cell interactions. A pair of quotations. So that it is apparent to penetrative intelligence that one can learn from the simplest and apply that to complexity, and that one can learn from one species and apply it to other species if one can settle in long enough to learn the nature of the situation and master the rituals of comportment, so that the language of accuracy can be distilled, held together by an idea that is structured by a synthesizing symbol, and that this entire pattern is what integration is. And that no matter what's going on whatever level, this is the process to pursue. It's very simple. It's extremely effective. It's transmissible. But it takes the doing of it to operate. You cannot imagine it to operate and expect that anything will come out of it. You cannot hope for it to operate and expect anything to come out of it. And you cannot sporadically play at it and expect that there's going to be any results. It is a discipline, it is a concentration, it is a yoga in the most limpidly truthful way. And once mastered, works forever for you. And frees one from indoctrination, from propaganda, from the need and taste of false sugars, of surreptitious salts, of destructive poisons, without end. And so the ancient name for this process was therapeia. That a truthful education is a therapeia. I just noticed somebody who was going to come to the lecture who had come late and just shied away from the door, seeing the process was ongoing. You can always enter the process, but you will not have anything that will work unless you do it. And all I can guarantee is to hold my end of the polarity up. I will hold it up forever. I'm not going anywhere. I'm patrolling those boundaries, and the terrain is secure. But you need to occupy the center. Jane Goodall, in writing in her book, Through a Window, which is one of our pairs of texts now with the double helix, the structure of DNA, the structure of life on molecular atomic level, related to structure of life on primordial primates that are somehow related to us in a very mysterious way, in chapter 11, Sons and Mothers, which comes after a chapter earlier called Daughters and Mothers, which I will quote from in just a minute. Notice the family similarities. Notice that before Jane Goodall, no one thought of chimpanzees as individuals that belonged to families that had ongoing generational relationalities. And now after her, no longer will anybody ever look at chimpanzees as indistinguishable bits of stupid pre-hominid life. In the Prentice papers, the end papers of her first book, In the Shadow of Man, she puts the portraits of and the names of the individual chimpanzees that she follows and has been following for 36 years now, and has got to know the individuals and knows their parents, knows their brothers and sisters, knows their uncles, follows the relationship, has sat there in the forest long enough to learn. And what has she learned? Patrolling the boundaries is but one of the many duties that the young male chimpanzee must learn if he is to grow to be a useful member of society. So what young humans, young Homo sapiens sapiens, are initiated in male ceremonies of patrolling boundaries, and that is to be taken in a very wide sense, it isn't because they are sociologically conditioned by anything other than nature. And that to call nature a conditioning is a true misnomer. To use the words of Lucretius 2,000 years ago, it's the way things are. Now, we live in a decadent time when the most popular tribe is the tribe of exceptionistes. I am an exception to all of this. Yes, this is all right for them, not for me. The ego is always a bona fide card-carrying member of the exceptionistes. Not me. I am an exception. Nature has a very swift way of taking the exceptionistes out. Now, we live in a time where the genetic forms are unraveling at a terrifying rate, AIDS being but one of a whole spectrum of situations. If males patrol the boundaries on level of chimpanzees, and females hold center on level of chimpanzees, what about Jane Goodall when she had a child, when she had a son? Her first son was born while she's in the field many, many years ago. I was at the Gombe stream for several months during 1966, she writes, 30 years ago, when my first child was on the way. And also during the following year when he was with me as a tiny baby. Do you understand that to get educated right, when you're pioneering, you have to live there in the process. You simply live the process. How did she get to live the process where she took her tiny baby with her into the field and he grew up there? In that situation, she got it because she was magnetized by someone who had it before her, who awakened in her own tenacity. It was her tenacity, but it had to be awakened. Who was her teacher? Her teacher was Lewis Leakey. She writes earlier in her first book, In the Shadow of Man, if you are interested in animals, someone said to me about a month after my arrival in Africa, then you should meet Dr. Leakey. Because Dr. Leakey had spent a whole lifetime occupying a terrain, sitting in, taking a front row chair on an area that's in the Great Rift Valley of East Africa. He had been born in that region. He was a member of the Kikuyu speaking tribe that was in that area. In his autobiography, it's not called Lewis Leakey English Colonial, it's called White African. He dreamed in Kikuyu, not in English. He writes here in the very beginning, page 10, page 11, about how European anthropologists are misled and misunderstand and misunderstood consistently and misled whole populations of people because the Kikuyu spit in their hand before they shake your hand. They used to do that. Is not spitting a reviling? It's an age-old reviling. Yes, it is. And it is for the Africans also. Because of similarities, because your spittle has the essence of who you are. And that someone who has your spittle can do something to that spittle and it'll happen to you. Sympatheia, similarity, sympatheia. And early rituals all built on similarity, on sympathy. Sir James George Frazer called it sympathetic magic that passed into general concourse. Here's what Lewis Leakey in White African says. The custom, which is closely linked with that of spitting on the palm of the hand before shaking hands, owes its origin to the deep-rooted belief in black magic, which is common to the Kikuyu and other African tribes. It is believed that the surest way to kill someone is to take some part of him, a piece of hair, a paring from toe or fingernail, or some spittle. And with it make black magic. The victim will then die by supernatural agency. Well, then why did they used to spit in their hands, to shake hands in the deepest, sincere way? And Leakey explains, because he was African himself. He's a white African. As a corollary to this belief, it follows that the best way to show your friendship to or faith in another person is to give him some part of yourself wherewith he may kill you should he so desire. Hence, if you are about to shake hands with a great friend or with an influential member of the tribe or even with a stranger to whom you wish to show respect or humility, you spit upon the palm of your hand and then shake hands with him, thereby transferring some of your spittle to him and so putting yourself at his mercy. Similarly, if you have been admiring someone's children or their flocks and herds, it is incumbent upon you to prove that you have not surreptitiously cast an evil eye or other spell upon them, and so before leaving, you expectorate upon them, you spit upon them, a gesture which proves your good intentions. Should you omit to do so, and then the children or animals which you had admired were to sicken or die, you would at once be suspect. This idea of spitting at other people's animals or children and of spitting into the hand before greeting a friend is quite unintelligible to most Europeans, to whom the act of spitting denotes hatred and contempt. It is therefore fortunate that the Kikuyu had come to realize something of the Europeans' attitude to such behavior before the white population became as numerous as it is today. Otherwise, the custom might have been the cause of much ill feeling. Leakey was so much a part of the African people, who were so much a part of the landscape, meaning of the animal ecology, meaning of the very roots of nature, that Leakey could take a front row seat in a rocky gorge, Old Duvai, and patiently sift through the decades to find something which he intuited would be there, that is to say, the earliest traces of man. Not of man 10,000 years ago or 100,000 or even a million years ago, but of several million years ago. And he was fortunate to have Mary Leakey with him all that time, because the two of them made a perfectly interesting pair. Mary Leakey was so deeply loved by him that she could assume the masculine rituals of patrolling the boundaries, and Lewis Leakey could assume the feminine ritual of staying in the tent and the camp at the center. And by exchanging the classic natural male-female differentiation roles, they turned the entire nature inside out, which is a shamanic quality. The shaman turns nature inside out. The primordial costume of the shaman is to wear the bones on the outside of the body, not on the in. Being turned inside out is the ancient medicine wisdom way of exploring the unknown. And so Mary and Lewis Leakey became a shared present shamanic pair, the first in many thousands of years. They took their children into the field. Richard and all the rest of them were raised there in the field. And so when Jane Goodall first came to Lewis Leakey, when he first saw her in Nairobi, he was in the museum at that day, not out at Old Duvai in that day, he immediately hired her as a secretary. And after she got affine to he and Mary, to that shared present shaman pair looking for millions of year old bits of hominid origins, he confided into her that part of the penetration of sitting there in that front row seat of trying to understand our origins was that nobody had ever lived with the other primates, with the gorillas, with the chimpanzees, with the great apes that are very closely related to us. Our DNA is separated by about 1% of the total. Fraction. That they are so similar to us that we could learn something about our origins and our most distant ancestors by living with them. And he suggested to her that there was a place over on Lake Tanganyika where the Gombe stream came into it that was a chimpanzee preserve, and that it might be interesting for someone just to go there and stay put. And Jane Goodall went there and has stayed put for almost 40 years and has learned remarkably that chimpanzees have a ritual structure that's very close to early man, though completely different in some respects. She writes then about her carrying her first child into the field as a little baby, while she's watching the chimpanzee mothers with their little infants. And out of a band of about 30 or 40 chimpanzees, they might have one or two babies in a year or a couple of years. So infant chimpanzees are rare enough that all the other chimps are very interested. She writes, 1966, this took place. I watched the chimpanzee mothers coping with their infants with a new perspective. She was one of that group called new mothers, trans species. From the start, her husband Hugo and I had been impressed with many of their techniques, and we made a deliberate resolve to apply some of these to the raising of our own child. First, we determined to give our baby a great deal of physical contact, affection, and play, which at that time, among English people, this is going to spoil the child. You don't hug them and hold them and play with them and kiss them all the time. She did. He was breastfed more or less on demand for a year, whenever. Not at meal times, not at set schedule times, not at sociologically defined proper moments, a la English colonial mentality, but whenever. He was not left to scream in his crib. Picked up immediately, hugged, held, played with. Whenever we went, we took him with us, not left separate from the life that was being lived, but integrated as basic part, so that his environment was often changing, his relationship with his parents remained stable, and the child learned the male-female balance, the stability within the movement. That they go together, that they're not separate, they're not polarized, they're not this or that, but they're together. When we punished him, we quickly gave him reassurance through physical contact, and when he was small, we tried to distract him rather than simply prevent him from doing something naughty. As he grew older, it became increasingly necessary, of course, to temper chimpanzee techniques with our own common sense. After all, we were dealing with a human, not a chimpanzee infant. We tried not to punish him for errors until he reached an age when he could understand the reason behind the reprimand, and we continued to keep him with us and to give him frequent physical and mental reassurance. One of the chimpanzee alpha males, the toughest male in the band, is called the alpha male. After he'd been the leader of the band for 18 years, he liked to still go and play with his mom from time to time for a couple of hours. Part of the reason that he was alpha male was that he was trusted by the entire group because he was at home in the whole group. Has our method of bringing him up been successful? We cannot say as yet. We can only point out that today, at 4 years of age, he is obedient, extremely alert and lively, mixes well with other children and adults alike, is relatively fearless, and is thoughtful of others. In addition, and quite contrary to the predictions of many of our friends, he is very independent. But then, of course, he may have been like this anyway, even if we'd brought him up in quite a different way. But I think you get it. Richard Leakey, the son of Lewis and Mary Leakey, who has become even more famous than they, refused to take part in finding fossils of early hominids. For much of his early life, he just simply dreaded and used to play and try to get away from it. But he found that he had the deep intuitive penetration to the center that he got from his mother, and he had the uncanny ability to touch the bounds that were invisibly there, even though they were not apparent, through exploring that he got from his father. Only those roles had been reversed shamanically in his family, and so his uncanny ability to spot the center, the exactness, in the midst of wide-ranging exploration showed itself one time when flying in an airplane over an arid part of East Africa, far to the north of Olduvai Gorge. He looked out of an airplane at an uninhabited landscape, had not been inhabited for couple million years, and intuited the exact site where the plane landed. They came back, and at Kubi Fora they found some of the most remarkable of all the early hominid traces, because he had this magic. He had this ability, and has it still today, because he was raised in a way in which nature was resonant with the life activities, with the language, with the synthesis of the synthesizing symbols. And on that level of integration, man is not only wise, he is wisely wise. Our species is double named. It's paired wisdom man, not just wisdom, but wisdom, wisdom man. We not only know, we know how to know. We know that we know. And so our species is remarkably elegantly refined. And when we are whole, when we are complete, we are also perfect. As the feminine completion fills out, the masculine perfection hones in. There was a time on this planet where inter-civilization wisdom reached one of the greatest waves of apex ever in the second, early third centuries of the Common Era. The great goddess at that time was named the Lady Prajnaparamita, the great lady of the perfection of wisdom. Who later became Kuan Yin in China, and who earlier had been Inanna in ancient Sumeria. And one finds, if one can have the patience to sit in to the energy wave of civilization over thousands of years in the context of billions of years of nature, one can learn to instantly understand and see, spontaneously get completely and perfectly exactly what is there. And with that kind of capacity, one can step off confidently into the unknown and go wherever you would like to go, because you can navigate from scratch, even though there was never a trail there. Now, this sounds good as a Star Trek motto, to boldly go where man has never gone before, and yet when you look at the Star Trek formula of reduction, you can see that they don't so boldly go to rehashes of all kinds of feudal and medieval scenarios that never are going to happen between the star systems. Because on that scale, the universe is very mysterious and very remarkably different from tribal qualities, even though tribal qualities are passed on and inherent and in the structure, they transform constantly on different levels, and we're not going to replay space opera. The similarities that are there are similarities, they're in no way repeats. And one has to understand that in order to go anywhere at all, now, one has to be educated. Now, in this education, in this preparation, we talked last week about how white light is total color. That when you put a crystal prism in a shaft of white light, of normal light, like from our star. The star's name is Sol, and so our sun is named Sol, and so the star system is called the solar system. If we were at another star, say Arcturus, it would be the Arcturian system, not the solar system. The planets that circle stars dozens of light years from here are not solar systems. They are star systems that are named after their star. And indeed, there are star systems without end. This education is made for sentient life to explore the unknown on level of star systems without end. But works very well on navigating out of impossible polarized dead end that is here now. The white light seen as total color means that one can use in expressions of phase form development a rainbow in its completeness for the perfection of white light. That in a logical form of expression, zero and infinity are exchangeable. They work in each other's place without losing any accuracy whatsoever. And that the zero base of nature becomes an infinite base of purpose without losing any of its accuracy. So that mystery and multiplicity have an exchangeability on level of perfect comprehension. And when one has perfect comprehension and mystery and multiplicity are exchangeable, the polarities transform into complementarities. And what was the middle of a line becomes the center of a circle. And the circle all by itself becomes like an infinity sign, a double attractor, so that they're always a paired quality of circleness. And though existence likes to hone in to circles, mystery likes to keep the pairedness, and the natural reality that occurs is a meeting, a montage, a marriage of the two. So that when one looks for the center of a star system, the exact center of a star system is never the star. The star always has its motion, its orbit in its star system, vis-a-vis whatever other bodies happen to be there in that star system. If there are planets, or if there are other stars, or if there's just debris, or if there's just gas, or whatever it is. So that the center of a star system is always a barycenter, which is a theoretical, theoria means contemplation, a contemplative mental center, which is the barycenter, of the electromagnetic energy in its circumambulation around. And so our star, soul, is not at the exact center of our star system either. It's very close to it, but not at the exact center. Because all the planets and moons and asteroids exert a very small fraction of the gravitational attraction, but nevertheless enough to set it off. And the offset is the way by which, in the mid-1990s, one can now measure whether there are planets of certain size, usually around 2 to 3 times the size of Jupiter, around other stars. In late 1995, the technique was first refined enough to be used accurately, and now almost every month, planets around close neighboring stars are being found. Large planets the size of Jupiter are larger. And as the technique is refined more and more, the exactness will show which stars have planetary systems, and there are many without end, beyond counting, innumerable. And life is a consistent tapestry of evolution in this. So we live in a joyous, very large amplitude of reality, and to truncate that for any reasons whatsoever is ignorance. But to insist upon it is stupidity. We're trying to sensitize ourselves, even just initially, even if you just show up in a consistent manner, the magic of that insight will touch every aspect of your completeness and occupy the center of perfection that is yours from time immemorial. It's part of the territory. It's a part of the terrain. It's a part of the way in which we are. Now, we're going to look closer at the double helix next week, but I would like to bring in a quotation here. In trying to find the structure of the double helix, it became important for James Watson and his friend Francis Crick to wake up from the insistence on an equality, an identity, a like equals like mentality that was the last veil obscuring the true structure of the double helix form of DNA. This veil of insisting with very subtle stupidity that it must be like equals like, and though it turned out that like equals like in a similarity was an operating principle, the very operating principle misunderstood from the wrong angle of ignorant insistence veiled it. So if there's a mystery lesson here. The mystery lesson is the very exactness by which we could see occupies a place of blindness by which we do not see. As the American sage Black Elk once said, it's in the darkness of men's eyes that they become lost. More next week.